Dog Works Radio Network presents Mushing Radio, hosted by Robert Forto. Mushing Radio is about dog-powered sports, living in the Great White North, and mushing. Visit our website at mushingradio.com. Here is your host, Robert Forto.
Hello and welcome, everybody. This is Robert Forto, and you're listening to our 12th day Iditarod coverage here on KVRF 89.7 in the Matsu Valley. RadioFreePalmer.org is our live streaming site. You can also find an app for Radio Free Palmer on the App Store. You can listen to all of our community radio shows there, including ours. You can find our episodes on iTunes. Just search for Dog Works Radio. And we're all over social media. And during the Iditarod coverage, just about 24 hours a day, is our co-host, Alex Stein. And he is at Coldfoot Films on Twitter. I am at Robert Forto. And with that, Alex is from California, and he's calling in today from maybe a beachside somewhere, or maybe the car in a parking lot of a grocery store. Alex, how's it going?
It's going great, Robert. I'm actually, it's kind of boring today. I'm just calling in from the living room. So nothing too exotic. But, you know, this continues to be, in a lot of ways, an amazing race this year. We have, I'm looking at the standings right now, we have 52 teams that have already finished. Looks like Kristen Bacon is between safety and Nome, so she'll likely finish sometime in the next half hour, 45 minutes. We've got three other teams out of White Mountain and a bunch of teams in White Mountain. And then we have the last four teams who are sort of traveling more or less together. What the teacher on the trail this year has borrowed the NCAA tournament nomenclature and referred to them as the final four. So we have Cindy Abbott, Paul Hansen, Al Eichens, who we'll talk about a little bit later as well, and Peter Reuter, whom we talked about yesterday, who are all at the back of the pack, but they are all well on their way to White Mountain. And should get there, you know, probably within the next few hours. So we are very definitely looking at a red lantern coming in by, I think, sometime early tomorrow afternoon.
You know, that is an absolutely fast race. White Mountain is, what, 77 miles from Nome, is that right?
Yeah. And as longtime listeners know, there's a mandatory eight-hour stop in White Mountain. So you get into White Mountain, and you're there for 8 hours. Sort of slows you down, prevents a lot of people, I think, from making last-minute mistakes. You get a chance for maybe a little bit of rest. Certainly the dogs get a chance for a little bit of rest. And then you have that typically 77-mile kind of sprint to the finish, which – you know, of course, it depends on the team, and some people are faster than others, but usually you can figure around 10 hours for most teams to get from White Mountain to Nome.
Right. Like we talked about earlier in our coverage, a really fast Iditarod team is somewhere in the 8-mile-an-hour range, and a much slower team is somewhere in that 5-mile-an-hour range. So, yeah, it is a typical run of 8 to 10 hours for that last push. And, of course, the dogs can smell the barn, so to speak, when they get closer to Nome, and they probably kick it into high gear once they see those lights coming around the bend there and onto the coast and on into the little village there. So, yeah, I'm looking forward to everybody finishing probably before we're on air tomorrow afternoon. That will be a pleasant surprise. Typically, we are still talking about folks on the trail during our final show of the season when the banquet's going on. So it's an exciting time to see just how fast the race is, and I know we're going to talk a little bit about that in sort of our featured story tonight, but before we do, I know you have a couple of quick tidbits. What's on your mind?
Yeah, so we got the autopsy results from a couple of the dogs that had died, and that was that the ITC released early this morning or possibly late last night. Flash, who was a dog on Catherine Keith's team, who collapsed on the trail, was found to have died from acute aspiration pneumonia. And a condition, it says here, often brought on by inhaling foreign substances into the lungs, such as food, liquid, or vomit. And they are doing further tests to see if they can figure out exactly what the cause was there. And then Schilling, who is a 3-year-old male dog who died around Unalakleet, was determined to have had abnormalities with extensive pulmonary edema. And that condition also is caused or exacerbated by having too much fluid in the lungs. So they're doing further tests on both of these dogs to see if they can figure out exactly what happened and exactly what caused it, so that moving forward, if there is something that can be done to prevent these kind of conditions or some tests that could pick these up earlier, they will do that, because the goal is always to have all of the dogs get there happy and healthy.
If I could comment on that just for a second, I know a lot of people are thinking, aspiration into the lungs, how could that possibly happen? How can pneumonia happen with sled dogs that are so used to the cold? And for folks that have never been around a team of sled dogs, and in particular at a race, sled dogs eat extremely fast. They eat their entire ration of kibble and meat, whatever is the meal for the evening, in about 30 seconds. We train our dogs to eat that fast. We want them to eat very heartily and as quickly as possible. And it's just sort of a trait of sled dogs, much different than your typical house pet that may graze on his bowl of food all day long, going back and forth to the kitchen, getting a bite or two here and there. And when that happens, of course, just like with us, if we eat too fast, we tend to get food down the wrong pipe, so to speak. And that's probably what's happening to these dogs as well. And, it's definitely not a musher error problem. It's just a genetics of sled dogs issue. Every dog I've ever seen, that's how you want your dogs to eat, very quickly, very precisely, and to get it in and get it out as quickly as possible.
Right. And, as we've mentioned before, although I don't think it's come up this year, these sled dogs will, when they're out on a race like Iditarod, they will be eating 12,000, sometimes more than that, calories per day. So generally these are dogs that will be snacked a few times and will have several large meals. So it's not just like your family dog that you might feed twice a day. These are dogs that are going to be eating a tremendous amount, and as you said, very, very quickly when they're out on the trail.
Right, right. Yeah, so unfortunately we have had 5 dog deaths this year, which is a higher number than most. Did another one pass away since we've been on last night, Alex?
Not that I had heard of. It's interesting because every year there are a couple of people who take to social media and sort of attack the Iditarod and talk about what they consider cruel treatment of the dogs. And this year, and there was one person in particular who would do that every year at Iditarod, and this year that person seems to have discovered how to create multiple Twitter accounts, because I've been looking on Twitter, and it seems that sometimes there are 8 or 10 Twitter accounts that are tweeting the exact same thing in the exact same words, condemning the Iditarod at approximately the same time. So it's designed to make it seem like there is this huge groundswell of opposition, whereas most of it can really be traced to a couple of people.
Right. And, that's just sort of the nature of the Internet. I've been reading a lot of post, backdated post since I was out on the trail for the last 6 days. I really tried to before our show this evening, and man, what a bunch of vitriol that has gone on in the last few days. I know we don't want to rehash old news, but it seems to get worse and worse every year, doesn't it, Alex?
Yeah, it really does. And you know, I don't think either of us want to go through the whole argument again, but there really seems to be a lot of people who are just choosing sides and you know, setting down lines, and anyone who crosses the line is horrible and is not a friend of theirs, and you know, people who just can't actually see that there might be some value to a different position. I know we see this in all sorts of ways, especially on social media, and certainly the polarization of the political situation has not helped this at all. But it actually makes me very sad to see this, to see people attacking each other as much as they have been over the past couple of days. And you know, a lot of the mushers and a lot of former mushers who have weighed in on this are just completely disgusted with the way some people have been talking to each other.
You know, Alex, I know you're a pretty middle of the road guy. You don't really pick a side, good or bad. I mean, you're out to really tell the stories. And, you know, we talk about a little bit of everything on here, from the dog deaths to the musher struggles to the politics of the race, et cetera, et cetera. If you could be sort of a social media moderator during Iditarod, what would you say to these folks that would, you know, that would kind of calm the storm, so to speak?
The one thing I would say, and I'm not sure that it actually would calm the storm, but the one thing that I would say is there's a lot more going on than you know about. There's a lot more going on in the race. There's a lot more, you know, that's going on with any particular musher's race and how it's going. We have such a limited view, even though we have the trackers now, and that gives us a lot of information. We have a lot of interviews. We have a lot of videos that the Insider posts and stuff. But that's still giving us a very, very small view into this. And so I would just urge people, you know, not to be so harsh in judging someone, not to be so harsh in judging someone if they, you know, if they drop a dog, or if they decide to take a slightly longer run than they might have been, or if they sleep for 20 minutes longer in a checkpoint than they should have, or you know, or people, I've heard all sorts of unbelievably horrible things that people are saying about Mark Nordman, the race marshal, ever since this controversy erupted a couple days ago, and you know, whatever else you want to say about Mark Nordman, whatever disagreements you have about his decisions or one particular decision, you know, this is not a guy who is evil. This is not a guy who is out to hurt anyone. You know, this is a guy who has a lot of different priorities that he's trying to balance, and I don't know what all of them are, and you don't, and I'm sure most of the mushers don't either. But he's someone who's trying to answer to a whole lot of different people, and is in a position where sometimes the things he's going to do are going to make people unhappy, and that's kind of inevitable with being the race marshal and having to make hard decisions. And so, you know, we can disagree with him, but. There should be a limit, I would think, to saying that someone is evil. I mean, this is a guy who has been devoted to this race for a very, very long time. And I think that even if you disagree with some of his decisions, if you don't acknowledge that he is trying his best under very difficult situations a lot of the time to do what's best for the race and what's best for the mushers and the dogs. I'm not sure what to say to someone who can't acknowledge that.
You know, I agree with you, and like you said, it's sort of the nature of social media, keyboard warriors, so to speak, that feel that they can say whatever they need to say, and a lot of times it's just to stir up a controversy, and I don't think that that's beneficial to anything, and no matter what sport or what arena, whether we're talking about politics, religion, whatever, you know, as your mom always says, if you don't have anything nice to say, don't say anything at all. But I think it's a little bit different world from the 1970s when I grew up and, 2017 in the world that we live in today. Alex, let's talk a little bit about a conversation that was happening today, also on social media, but I think it was a good one. Craig Medred, we've had him on the show a couple of times now. He's a renowned reporter, used to work for the Alaska Dispatch and is now sort of a freelance writer, but he posted an article today summarizing just about how fast the race has become and should we think about somehow slowing it down. I know you got a chance to read the article this morning as well, and I'm interested in talking a little bit about some of the comments from not only fans but also mushers and other folks that had some great comments and great ideas about the good and bad of slowing down the Iditarod just a little bit. What are your thoughts?
It's a very interesting thing because the race has you look at the race in 1973, and granted, it was different, and there was a lot more breaking trail, and there was in some ways more of a camping trip than a race, at least until it got closer to the end. But the race has gotten faster, in general terms, as time has gone by, and we saw the first 12-day Iditarod, and then we saw the first 11-day Iditarod, and then the first 9-day Iditarod, and every year is getting faster and faster, and that's kind of exciting. So on the one hand, I do like that there are new records that can be set, as the dogs get more powerful and faster, and we learn more about how they run and nutrition and all things like that. But it does seem like, especially if there's any sort of correlation between the increased speed and the health of the dogs, I think that it might benefit to slow down the race a little bit.
You know, I agree with you. And his main point to that was, in order to slow it down, all they have to do is calm down or slow down the grooming of the trail. Just don't groom it as well. And as you know, you had just mentioned the early days of the races. Many times there would be trail breaking by the mushers. They would be out in front of their teams with snowshoes and, you know, really plugging away at making their own trail. And now it's almost an Alaskan highway out there where the trail is almost perfectly groomed. It's groomed so well that other sports are using it during the year, the fat bikers and the walkers and, you know, the runners and skiers and whatnot that do the Iditarod Trail Invitational. There's snow machine traffic up and down most of the trail throughout the winter, so it really packs it down. So it's a much different trail than it was even 10 years ago. And another point was made, Alex, where they were saying that it's a much faster trail at the beginning because in this year in particular, because it doesn't slow down at the Alaska range. So by the time that all the teams get up and over the mountains and then into the Farewell Burn area and then all of the middle third of the race that we've often talked about, all the teams have slowed down considerably compared to this year's race, where they hit the starting line right out of the chute and were rocking and rolling on the rivers for several hundred miles before they saw a lot of change in terrain. And there was a comment made about how that happens in marathons. If you really shoot out of the gate during the marathon, you may pick up a little bit of time at the first few miles, but you're going to really feel that in the last third of a marathon, where your body responds much differently than it did at the start. And I think that they call it the marathon slump or something like that, and you really have to get over that hump in a human-based marathon in order to be able to push through the finish. And there was good and bad comments on both sides of that. What were your thoughts on those?
Yeah, you know, I think we've seen one of the things that also has happened, in addition to it being a faster race because of the rerouting it to Fairbanks, is we've seen many, many fewer scratches than normal. And part of that is that people going down the steps, people going down, you know, the Dalzell Gorge, it even in years when there's a lot of snow, and even in years when it's a really good trail, that is a part of the trail that takes a lot out of people. It's a much more difficult and challenging type of mushing than what we've seen in this year's trail. And I'm not saying that any of this is easy, and it's certainly not easy to do this for 1,000 miles. But in comparison to going over the Alaska Range and the traditional first third of the Iditarod Trail, what we saw was really a trail that was built for speed.
Right.
And even though there were parts of it that got chewed up a little, and you know, parts when people were riding the brake and the snow would get chewed up a little bit, it still seemed to be significantly faster than it had been in 2015 when they ran the same route, and certainly than the past few years with the normal non-Fairbanks part of the trail.
And one last point on speeding up the race. There was a lot of comments about to Iditarod, it doesn't make a whole lot of economical sense to slow down the race as well, because as we know, it's a lot of logistics, a lot of time, a lot of money, a lot of effort for much longer races. Even just by a day or two longer, a lot of resources have to go into that. And there was also comments made about just like in any other sporting event, if your team is finished or if the game is quote unquote over, interest falls off real quick. And something that I think about is the Olympics. You know, if the United States is playing, you know, a powerhouse like Russia or China or Sweden or something in a very highbrow event, whether it be hockey or whatever, the lower-ranked teams don't get near the interest, near the coverage, near the following, because it's just not the big game, so to speak. And I know that happens with Iditarod as well. What are your thoughts on those two?
Yeah, that is definitely true. And I think we've seen in the past some people get a little bit bent out of shape when mushers who are going more slowly either are withdrawn or are pressured to scratch. You know, we saw Ellen Halverson this year was, I believe, at one point more than 300 miles behind the leaders, and there was a lot of concern about, you know, not just the distance, but the fact that she was falling several checkpoints behind, and you have to keep moving the staff and the volunteers up the trail to go from checkpoint to checkpoint. And at a certain point, if you're just doing that for one musher, it becomes very, very difficult to keep that going. You know, with what you said about the interest too, I noticed that watching some of the teams come in the past few days, we have seen, you know, when the winter comes in, there's always thousands of people on the street, and it's very, very exciting. And that was true when Mitch won. But by the time the fifth and sixth place teams were coming in, there were, you know, just a few dozen people around the arch. And I always want to, and I know a lot of people go up specifically to see the winner and then they come back a day or two later, but there's still a lot of people in Nome, and it seems to me like, you know, I know people are busy and have other things to do, but if you're in Nome, why not go out to the, when you hear the siren, why not go out and greet people in when they come in? I mean, I don't care if it's someone who's second or someone who's 52nd. This is someone who has done an enormous, amazing, seemingly impossible thing with riding the runners with a dog team that's just gone 1,000 miles, and I think that's really worth celebrating. And to someone like me, yeah, it's exciting to see who does best and who's in the top 10 and the top 20. But anyone who comes in, I just want to go out and celebrate them.
Oh, yeah, I agree. And, you know, it's been part of our strategy here on our show is we have, I think it was just 1 year when you and I hosted that we decided to end our coverage early. And I know we talked about it in the off season, so to speak. And we said we want to make sure that we tell our stories at least through the banquet, because there are so many more people out on the trail. And I thought that we were doing those folks a disservice by not continuing our coverage every night and at least making sure that we at least go through the banquet and talk about what's happened on the trail up to that point. Do you remember we talking about that? We talked about that?
Yeah, and you know, I remember one of the first times that I came up to Iditarod, I was talking the day before the ceremonial start to one of the mushers who had his team hooked up in back of one of the local hotels, and I was just talking to him about his training and what he was looking forward to and things like that, and he said that the one thing that really bothered him is that people in the media seem to think that there's only four or five teams running this race. And he said,
right,
you know, it's important for fans and for the media and for people covering and talking about the race to remember the people in the middle and at the back. And that has really always stuck with me.
Yeah, so we definitely have some racing still happening. As you mentioned, just about everybody will finish by tomorrow. Kristen Bacon is currently the next musher to come in. She is on her way from safety to Nome, it looks like, or just about getting ready to leave. I don't have the tracker here. Then Misha Wiles, I believe is how you pronounce it, Zoya Denor, Joe Carson, and then Thomas Rosenblum are the next folks getting ready to make that final push with Peter Reuter and Alan Eichens currently at the back of the pack. And that's who we're talking about tonight, Alan Eichens. And remember, folks, if you do miss the rest of the show, you can find us after the stream has ended and the complete episode will be there. So we're just going to get started on our musher profile for this evening, and then we'll run over some time. Alex, what do you have for us about Alan?
So Alan is 56. This is his third Iditarod. He grew up in Attic, which is a village in the Aleutian Islands. And while he was living there, he developed a fondness for outdoors and activities involving outdoors. He then lived for 10 years on St. Lawrence Island, where he was working construction. He was in Nome in 1978 when Dick Mackey won the race by 1 second, the sort of photo finish of the Iditarod. He was one of the people in the crowd for that, and he said that it has always stuck with him. And from that point on, he decided that he wanted to one day be running dogs, but couldn't really do it where he was living for a long time, and then eventually moved back to to the mainland, I guess. I don't know if people say that in Alaska. Moved back to Wasilla, and then was able to pursue his dream of racing dogs. He ran the Iditarod for the first time in 2015, and when he finished, there were many of his former neighbors from St. Lawrence and from some of the Aleutians who were there to greet him. He has a very colorful green sled bag, and if you see it, it's a very distinct color, and he carries a plush chicken on top of the sled bag, which he says he carries with him in every race. He has decided that he is dedicating this race and all of the races that he runs to kids who suffer from pediatric stroke, pediatric cancer, and pediatric kidney disease. And he started doing that because the daughter of a close friend of his had pediatric cancer. And when he qualified for and then was running Iditarod in 2015, Alaska Airlines bought an Iditarider seat and gave it to the daughter of his friend who had the pediatric cancer so she could ride the first 11 miles in the sled with him. And then Alan and his family started a fundraising and crowdfunding push, and Alaska Airlines again cooperated and kicked in some money for that. So they were then able to bring the little girl and her family to Nome for the finish to watch him come in. This year, he is carrying the ashes of a baby who died of kidney disease at 3 days old, as well as ashes of his aunt and her husband who lived on St. Lawrence Island when he was there. He said that the way this first happened, the way he first got into mushing and got involved with it, was he had a business where they were making clothing, and he made a high tech coat for Dallas Seavey to wear, and Dallas got to know him, and Dallas said, well, if you ever want to come down and we'll go for a sled ride. And one day he did, and Dallas, you know, put a bunch of dogs in front of a sled, put them on the runners, had a second sled, which Dallas took and led them out. And he said that, I heard an interview with Alan, and he said that if you're interested in dog mushing, never get on a sled, because if you do, you will never get off. And he said the other problem he had is that he started getting dogs, and he said that's another big red flag, because you get one dog and then you get two dogs, and before you know it, you have 25 dogs. His first dogs that he got were from Mitch Seavey, and he's been breeding dogs ever since then for the last, I guess now, over 10 years. And he is just a really kind of amazing guy who just feels a very deep connection to these things. He is very much a back of the packer. As you mentioned, he's one of those last four, so it's not clear if he'll get the Red Lantern or if he'll, you know, be one or two people in front of the Red Lantern, but he'll be around in there. On his website, he had a picture of two of the little girls who had pediatric brain cancer holding a poster for him that said, "You be our legs and we'll be your heart." And that's something that he's really very clearly taken to be a very important part of his Iditarod experience. And, you know, we've talked a lot of times about people choosing to run the race for different reasons, and there's always at the heart of it a love of dogs and a love of Alaska, but it's always, for me, really amazing and inspirational to find people who are running this race for a specific purpose, and especially if it's a purpose as great as this one.
You know, Alex, that's what I'm talking about. These guys, they're winning their own race no matter where they're at, first, middle, or last. Everybody's out there for their own personal reasons. And when you hear stories about Allen and everybody we showcase on our show, every one of them has a very unique and very distinct story to tell. And I just don't know what the hubbub is about with all of this negativity over the race when you have 62-odd absolutely wonderful stories to tell out there. And like you said, if they're not your friend, you need to bash them in some way. And I think that that's just – that is just utterly disgusting in my view, and I will take the side, as you mentioned, a lot of musher friends out there and former Iditarodders who do say that. But man, what a story that Allen has going with the folks that he's out there representing and the story that he has to tell. And you know, I did not know about the chicken. That is a very interesting part of it. And for folks that are listening, I may have said this before, I have no idea who Alex is going to talk about when we mentioned their names on the previous day. So I always learn something about these folks every time. I have no idea where you get your stories from, Alex. I know you peruse all sorts of media sources out there, not just Iditarod Insider, but all of the little tidbits and nuggets that you find on these little interviews here and there. That's some good reporting, Alex. I got to commend you for that.
You know, I always feel like, well, first of all, thank you. I always feel like there's so much more that I wish I could get, and you know, I feel like, oh, I wish I could just spend like 20 minutes with each of these people every night, and you know, and someday I'll figure out a way to do that. But until then, there's a lot of information out there. You know, you have to dig for it. But there's a lot of different people talking and writing about a lot of these mushers and doing interviews with them. I think of these days, there seem to be a lot more video clips and interviews with mushers than there were when we started doing this a few years ago. So that's always really interesting and enjoyable for me to go through and look at these things.
All right. Well, Alex, we're just about out of time. We will be back on the air at this same time, I believe, 4 o'clock Alaska time. Saturday, our last 2 days of coverage here on Mushing Radio. Who is your musher profile for tomorrow?
So tomorrow we're going to talk about Ken Anderson, who announced either right before the race or during the race that this is going to be his last Iditarod. So we're going to talk about Ken a little bit tomorrow.
Excellent. Yeah, Ken Anderson is he's up there in terms of a top kennel for sure. He's been competing a long time, and he is definitely a very strong contender for at least the in the money, so to speak, as they say, the top 30 places. He's usually there. So yeah, I'm looking forward to hearing about Ken as well. Anything else you want to mention before we close our coverage?
You know, just that there are still people on the trail. The race isn't over until they take the widow's lamp down off the Burled Arch and put it out. And so there's a lot more stuff that can happen. And certainly for the last 10 or so people who are going to come in the next 24 hours or so, it's important that those of us who are fans of the race realize that they're still going. And I say this a lot, but I don't think I've said it this year. As someone who is a fan of the race, I certainly have mushers that I have a soft spot for. I'll always have a soft spot for Allie Zirkel. I'll always want her to do really well. And there may be mushers that I prefer, you know, some a little bit more than others. I think this year I was really hoping that the winner would be someone whose last name wasn't Seavey. But that doesn't mean that I don't like Mitch Seavey or Dallas, and it doesn't mean that I can't admire what they've done. So, you know, maybe I would just say to people who are getting so upset and so vitriolic about, you know, about cursing out other people because of they support a decision or a musher, these are all people who are doing amazing things. So let's not lose sight of that.
And let's end with that. That's a great comment and a great way to end today's show. So on behalf of my co-host, Alex Stein, this is Robert Forto. We will see you guys tomorrow afternoon at 4 o'clock Alaska time for our Day 13 coverage of the 2017 Iditarod. We'll talk to you guys next time. Goodbye.